So, good evening, everyone. Welcome to RSOL in Action monthly teleconference, and we're going to get right into action here. We have a lot of people on the phone call, and a very exciting program with the agenda we have tonight. Those of you who registered or signed up for the call, you should have gotten an email reminding you of what we're going to be doing tonight, and it's also been sent out in general email. So the first part of the presentation is going to be with Professor David Post. We're going to be talking about an important case that's pending a cert petition before the U.S. Supreme Court, Packingham versus North Carolina. And we're going to have some updates from states. I know of at least one. We're going to have an update regarding international Megan's Law. We're going to have an update about the national conference. If all of that doesn't consume our time, we'll try to take a few questions. But we may not get to any questions with an hour and a half and all this on the agenda. Professor Post has joined us graciously, and we're going to get to him in a moment. But he's been a friend and I think a supporter of RSOL through the years, and he's joined a group of law professors, and they've asked the U.S. Supreme Court. The group of attorneys have filed an amicus brief asking the Supreme Court to grant review to this North Carolina case. So we're grateful for you to join us. The rest of the people that will be asking questions will be Robin from North Carolina, fittingly. Robin is one of our leaders, and he's also on the national board. You heard the lovely voice of Brenda Jones, who's our executive director, and we're going to have Barbara Gale, who is a semi-retired attorney from Georgia. And the three of us are going to pepper Professor Post with questions, and then if Janice has any issues, welcome to chime in as well. So you may have gotten the bio. He's retired from a distinguished career of a law professor and clerking for which justice was it of the U.S. Supreme Court?
Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And this case arises out of North Carolina with a statute that prohibits any registered sex offender from basically a registered sex offender from being on Facebook or social media where minors may interact. And I'm not the best versed in asking questions, so my questions are going to be generalized about the Supreme Court, and then Robin and Barbara are going to ask more specific questions. So did you want to say anything about the case before we start hitting you with your questions?
Yeah, just to make sure everybody is sort of generally aware, I'm sure most people are, about what the case does. The lower court in this case was challenged, the restriction on accessing social networking sites was challenged on the down in the trial court as an infringement of the First Amendment right to free speech and free association. The trial court agreed and struck the trial court actually disagreed. The appeals court agreed that it was an infringement of the First Amendment and invalidated the statute, and then the North Carolina Supreme Court overturned that and said it was a valid exercise of the state's power and didn't abridge the freedom of speech or the freedom of association. It's a very it's a strange and rather extreme opinion for reasons we can get into during the discussion. One of the reasons that we thought that it might be a good candidate for Supreme Court review. So we joined with some other groups who are petitioning the Supreme Court now to hear this case, hopefully to overturn it, but at least in the first instance just to hear it through what's called a petition for certiorari. So that's sort of that's basically where we are.
Okay, well, thank you, Professor. And like I say, my questions are going to be very generalized. When a person hears the term Supreme Court, and most of our audience is non-attorneys, when they hear the terms, the case is going to the Supreme Court, how does a person what is the vehicle that gets a person to the Supreme Court with their case, and what is the criteria before a person can even ask the Supreme Court to review their case?
That's a great question and widely misunderstood, I think, about how this works. Basically, there's a very small category of cases, that automatically, that automatically get reviewed in the Supreme Court. These are cases involving foreign ambassadors, cases involving states against other states, Nebraska versus Oklahoma and some border dispute. Those cases come up from time to time, and those automatically, there's a right to Supreme Court review. There's pretty much nothing else that in which you have a right to get the Supreme Court to hear your case. This has changed over the years. It used to be that there was what is called the mandatory jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. 75 years ago, there were a lot of cases that sort of automatically could be appealed to the Supreme Court, but there's virtually nothing now that automatically gets review. So what you do, if you have reached the highest court you can, in the state system of North Carolina, for example, if you've got a decision from the North Carolina Supreme Court, there's no higher court in North Carolina that you can appeal that to, you petition the Supreme Court, you ask the Supreme Court to hear the case. It's called a petition for certiorari or cert petition. The court gets about 12 or 13,000 of these a year. They grant maybe 90 or 100. And which ones they grant and which ones they don't is a little bit mysterious. But it goes more or less like this. It takes four justices. That's the first thing to know, is that this the so-called rule of four. It takes four justices to grant the petition to hear the case, even though ordinarily, of course, it takes five justices. There's a five justice majority requirement for most other decisions that the court makes. This is an exception. If four justices say you should hear the case, it gets scheduled for argument. The criteria can summarize them as follows. The most important thing to know about the criteria is that the court very expressly says we are not in the business of correcting the errors that lower courts make. Lower courts make errors all the time. We know that. They're human beings, and they make errors. They do things wrong. You get an automatic right of appeal. If you're in federal court, you can appeal from the district court to the appeals court. If you're in state court, you can appeal from the state trial court, state appeals court. You get an appeal in order to correct, hopefully, whatever errors have been made. But once you have done that, we, the Supreme Court, we're not here to correct those errors anymore. That's just not our job. Our job is to ensure that federal law, including the Constitution of the United States, and the federal statutes, are applied uniformly across the nation, so that the federal law in Maine, Maine may have its own state law about any number of things, but as far as federal law is concerned, the court in Maine is going to apply federal law the same way that a court in Missouri or a court in California is going to apply it. That's the goal, uniformity of federal law. So what the court mostly looks for when it decides whether or not to grant a petition is a case that can plausibly say, not only did the court make a mistake here, but it's in conflict with the way that another court elsewhere in the country has read the same statute or has read the Constitution of the United States. Having a conflict between courts is the far and away the best way to get surf. So what you try to do when you're writing a surf petition, one of the things you try to do is to say, we have conflicting opinions. There are other courts that have considered the very question that the North Carolina court considered and came out the other way. And if we can, if the court believes us and goes and looks at those other cases and says, yeah, those are, it really is the same question and they really did come out the other way, that has a very significant, you get a very significant likelihood that the court will hear your case. The other cases the court hears are cases of sort of overwhelming national importance, you know, Bush versus Gore or something like that. I mean, they will take cases where there's no split, there's no conflict among the courts, but just because it's so important, the gay marriage cases that they took, for example. But most of the cases they take are cases in which the petitioner, the person who wants the case heard, can persuade the court that there really is non-uniformity of federal law. Some courts are applying the Constitution in one way, and other courts, like this one, are applying it the other way.
Well, Professor, I work as a paralegal, and I've seen a number of cert petitions go to the Supreme Court, and none of them are ever granted. And your statistics just show us why. Isn't there a tremendous cost in printing the just out of pocket cost, not counting the attorney, of what it takes to get your material, your
yes and no, actually. I mean, most of those, I said there were something like 12,000 cert petitions in the Supreme Court. I would guess 9,000 of them are from, you know, three-quarters of them are from currently incarcerated prisoners who are petitioning because they are seeking habeas corpus release for some reason and on some grounds, and they're petitioning the court to hear their appeal. In fact, the filing fee, if you can establish that you are indigent, I think the court waives the filing fee. It waives the rules about, you know, there are all sorts of arcane rules about how big the paper has to be and the typeface and the font and the this and the that. One of the things I think as a clerk at the Supreme Court, I found it in a way quite inspiring, that at least you can ask the court to hear your case. No matter who you are, you have a right to ask them, hear this case. Now, the vast majority of those cert petitions, especially the ones from prisoners, I can tell you, all they say is, they can be summarized in one sentence, and that sentence is, I got screwed. my sister-in-law testified against me and she lied. My lawyer was a jackass. The prosecutor was biased against black people. The one thing after another, I got screwed. And the court routinely throws those in the garbage can. That's just, as I said, they don't view their job as correcting those sorts of mistakes. So that will get you nowhere. To just say in a petition, hey, the court below got it wrong, is never enough to get cert granted. Most people don't understand that when they submit these petitions, and they go on and on about how the court below made a terrible mistake, and the Supreme Court, in effect, shrugs its shoulders at that. It just does not see that. That is not its job in the, as it sees it in the federal system. Its job is to ensure that federal law is uniform, and the fact that courts make mistakes, you hope that the appeals courts below can fix those, but if they don't, that's just too bad.
So my last question is this case paid, or is this case where it's being done? Are the costs being I'm trying to figure out if there's somebody bearing the cost for this case.
Yeah, I'm not sure to be honest. Our effort was not paid. That is, there was a petition on excuse me. So Mr. Packingham, the defendant, loses his case before the North Carolina Supreme Court. A petition was filed on his behalf I believe I was not directly involved in that, the petition filed in the Supreme Court. I'm pretty sure that was done pro bono out of the University of Virginia, that the University of Virginia Law School Clinic prepared that that petition on behalf of the of Mr. Packingham, although I suspect that his whoever his lawyers had been up to that point were involved in that as well. But I think that that was pro bono for no fee. I joined a group of law professors who separately submitted an amicus brief to the Supreme Court, saying we support the cert petition. We think you should grant that petition for the following reasons. And that was pro bono. I don't know who, I forget to be honest, kind of who organized that. It's slipping my mind, but that was done on a pro bono basis, and nobody paid for that. There are plenty of people who have injustices done to them all the time who are not able to get, God knows, decent legal representation to make the case in the Supreme Court. But I think, luckily, in this case, there's some good. The court's getting some good lawyering. It makes a big difference. And we've done a reasonably good job. They may not grant the petition, but it's not for lack of some good lawyering on the part of both the UVA clinic and the law professors' brief, I think.
So well, I'm going to hand it off to Robin, and then followed by Barbara. They're going to have some questions when I'm done. Thank you for
great
for answering.
Sure.
Well, thank you, David. Thank you, Larry.
Sure.
And while I understand that your primary involvement has been with helping to put together the amicus, mm-hmm. I've selected from the petition actually mm-hmm. a couple of substantive questions that I think might be beneficial to the folks that are listening. Most importantly, could you tell us a little bit about why you think the North Carolina Supreme Court arrived at the decision that the prohibition was a legitimate prohibition because it dealt with conduct as opposed to speech, and that the speech was only incidental?
Yeah, that's a very important part of this decision by the North Carolina court. It is one of the things that I think is very clearly at odds, and the petition makes this point that it is at odds with lots of other cases. This notion that this is not a regulation of, a prohibition on accessing social networking websites is not a regulation of speech. It is a regulation of conduct. The accessing the website, and it only has an incidental effect on speech in terms of what might happen after you access the website. The reason this is important in this case is that the way First Amendment, to give you sort of a 60-second primer on First Amendment litigation and how First Amendment cases go, a critical question anytime you bring a First Amendment challenge to something the government has done, you say that the government has infringed your First Amendment rights. The critical question, first question that the court asks itself is, what level of scrutiny do I give to what the government has done? In an ordinary case, if you're challenging what the government has done, let's say your state has put a tax on ophthalmologists, or your town has said you can't paint your mailboxes green and you have to repaint your mailbox. So any number of things, sort of ordinary legislation that you think has harmed you and you want to challenge that. Courts, generally speaking, don't second guess the wisdom of legislative bodies. They don't... they give what is called rational basis scrutiny to laws like that. They just ask, did the legislature have a rational basis for thinking that this action would solve some problem? It doesn't have to be the best way to solve the problem. They don't have to even show that it's a good way to solve the problem. They don't even really have to show that it solves the problem at all. They just have to, government just has to show, we were not arbitrary. We were rational when we came up with this. We think that there's a problem of X, and we think rationally that this will help us deal with that problem. When it involves speech, however, when the regulation is not just an ordinary sort of regulation of economic relationships or something like that, but involves speech, courts demand more of the government. That's what the First Amendment gets you in court, is that you can say, wait a second, you're suppressing my speech, so you can't get away with just saying, well, we think it's a, sort of a good idea. The government has to satisfy what is called strict scrutiny of, it has a higher burden of justification. It has to show that it really, that what it has done really does attack a particular problem, that there is a relationship between, that it has real evidence that what it is doing actually solves a particular problem. It investigated alternative ways to solve that problem that were less speech invasive, and none of them work. So this is the least restricted way that we can deal with this problem. We have considered other alternatives and all that. That is a very substantial burden that the government has to bear. Occasionally it can meet it, but often it cannot meet it. And that's really what First Amendment litigation often is all about, is whether you can get the court to apply that sort of strict scrutiny, really demanding of the government kind of a solid showing of why this, whatever it has enacted, why that gets at the particular problem that they're claiming that it gets at, and why they couldn't have done it some other way that would have had less of a burden on speech. Okay.
So what was the level of scrutiny that the Supreme Court?
The level of scrutiny in this case is what's called is intermediate between those two bounds. And it's intermediate between those two because the court says there is a line of cases involving conduct. The best known case here is the draft card burning case from the 1960s. The United States had a regulation that said you cannot burn you cannot destroy your draft card, is what it said. Many people started, of course, in demonstrations burning their draft cards as acts of protest. And one of them was arrested, and he said, wait a second, that's an infringement of the right of free speech, and I should get strict scrutiny. The government has to really show that this is necessary to advance some very important governmental interest. And the court said, well, you know, actually this is a regulation. It's really not a regulation of speech. It's a regulation of conduct. The destruction of a card is a physical act. And it's true. It has incidental effects on speech. It does mean you can't burn your card in protest. But that's not its primary purpose. Its primary purpose is one that involves conduct, and when its primary purpose is one that involves conduct, we're going to give it a sort of wishy-washy intermediate scrutiny. We're going to ask a little bit more than we might ask of the government in an ordinary case, but they don't have to show us too much. They don't have to convince us that destroying draft cards is really a big problem. They just have to show that there is a problem and that it's administratively very cumbersome for them if somebody doesn't have their draft card, and that this is a reasonable way to deal with that problem is to have a statute that says you can't destroy your card. And then the fact that there's an effect on speech is too bad, but not unconstitutional. And we will also look to make sure that there's another class of cases in where the court says it's a regulation of conduct and not speech, and it gets this sort of intermediate scrutiny. And those are things like you can't have a march in the park after dark. You're not allowed to have an assembly of people marching in the park after dark, and that's because it's noisy and it makes traffic, and people don't like the noise, and it keeps up children late at night. And of course, those are so-called time, place, and manner restrictions. You're allowed to do now. Ordinarily, you could not say you may not have any political demonstrations in the park ever, but at night you're just regulating the conduct of people for reasons that have nothing to do with the suppression of speech. It has to do with the conduct involved, the noise, the parking, the cars, the traffic, et cetera. So courts give intermediate scrutiny in those cases as well. So what the North Carolina court did here, by saying this is a regulation of conduct, it allows it to give it this sort of intermediate form of scrutiny, a lowered form of scrutiny. I think that is clearly incorrect on the law, and I think most people that I've spoken to or I know who know more First Amendment law than I do would agree with that. That's a really striking holding. I analogize it to saying a law that if you said registered sex offenders or nobody's allowed to go into the libraries, no more public, you can't go into the public library. You may not go into the public library. And they said, well, that's just a regulation of conduct, because what all we're regulating is your actual movement into the library. What you do in the library is just incidental. It seems to me that that would be absurd. I think most people would agree that that's absurd. Or if they said no newspapers may use a printing press. No more printing presses may be used in the state of North Carolina. Now, they could say, well, that's just a regulation of conduct, printing presses, but I don't think most courts would say that's ridiculous. That is, in fact, a regulation of speech, both in the case of the library, people are getting information. That is a form of protected information communication under the First Amendment. The newspaper case, they're publishing newspapers, and you're not just regulating the act of walking over the library steps or turning on a printer. You're regulating the act of speaking and communicating. And those statutes would, I guarantee you, get strict scrutiny, the highest form of scrutiny, and the government would have to really explain in great detail why it has to take those measures, and I don't think they could possibly... I think the same thing is true here. To say that that's one of the startling holdings in this case is that to say that this is a regulation of conduct and not of speech would call into question all sorts of other decisions, I think, that the courts have made in the First Amendment area.
The court also reasoned in its decision that there were alternative options.
Yeah.
There were ample alternative options for registrants to participate in the in forums and engage in social media, and they made some comparisons that are a bit absurd. Do you want to pick it up from there?
Yeah, that's the second issue. So the first issue is this question of saying that it's a regulation of conduct. I think we have in the petition makes clear, I think, that this is a conflict. Again, remember what I said. To get the court to hear this, you not only have to say North Carolina court got it wrong, but that other courts have come out differently on the question. And federal, you know, the Constitution is now being read in different ways in different states. And I think we have cases from elsewhere that have invalidated restrictions like this on social networking on the grounds that it is a regulation of speech and that it does get the highest form of judicial scrutiny. So I think we have a conflict on that. The second point, which is on in the law professor's amicus brief is this one that you mentioned. One of the things, so if you're going to give a statute intermediate scrutiny, so again, in my example of the statute that says you may not march in the city park after 9 p.m., if that's challenged by someone who wants to hold a demonstration in the park at night, the state's burden is to show that they have some problem that they are solving by this measure that's not involved in speech suppression, but involved in something else. They're trying to, and in this case, it would be the traffic and the noise problem, et cetera. And they would also have to show, one of the requirements is that they have to show that there are still ample alternative mechanisms for speech, so that they're not prohibiting the people from speaking, just channeling it into more appropriate times or more appropriate places. And in the case of the park regulation, the city would say, look, you can hold your speech at 6 in the morning, you can hold your speech at noon, you can hold your march at 4 p.m., lots of other ways, or you don't have to hold it in the park also. You can go on the sidewalks or do this or do that. Lots of other alternatives for you to get your message across. And I think in most cases that would prevail. We would say, okay, that's part of the analysis. So here the North Carolina court says, yeah, well, it's true you can't use NewYorkTimes.com because it has you're allowed to have a profile. It's like a social networking site, in the, at least under this statute. It would be prohibited to you because it allows people under the age of 18 to maintain a user profile. But you can use your WARAL.com, which is the local, I gather, the local Raleigh, North Carolina radio station, which has a news site. And you don't have to use, and it's true, you can't use Facebook or Twitter, but you can use the Paula Deen network. Which is one that only allows persons over the age of 18, a social networking site that I had never heard of before, by the way, that does not allow people under the age of 18 to participate, so therefore is not prohibited under the statute. So our brief says that is crazy, as I think most people who hear that say that's absurd. To say that the Paula Deen network, which might have 2,000 users, is somehow an alternative to Facebook and Twitter, which pretty much reach everybody in the United States by this point and are dominant forms of social communication in this country, and political activity and religious activity and entertainment, et cetera, to say that it's an alternative, that there are other social networking sites, is both preposterous in terms of ordinary usage. No one would take seriously, I don't think, there's anybody out there who would take seriously if you said, well, you can't use Facebook, but you can use the Paula Deen network, so that's an alternative. But it's also inconsistent with the way the Supreme Court itself has analyzed these alternatives. There have been some cases in the past. I'll just give you one very quickly. There was a case a few years ago where the town ordinance prohibited people from putting up political signs on their lawns. You know, the sort of, you know, Jones for sheriff signs on their lawn. They were not allowed to do that. The city said, well, it's because it's distracting for drivers, and you know, it's a regulation of conduct. We don't really care, you know, it's not that we don't care whether it's Republicans or Democrats or what you say on the sign. You can't have a sign because it's bad for traffic control. And the Supreme Court struck that down. And one of the things it said was, you know, you don't really have alternatives to putting a sign on your lawn. Sure, you can buy a poster and put it up in your office, I guess, or put a picture in your window, or sign a petition or do a lot of other things, but that's really not a sign on your lawn communicates a very different message, and those other forms of communication don't communicate the same message, and we think there are no alternatives. You haven't provided through this regulation alternatives to this kind of speech. And our point was, if putting a poster up in your office is not a reasonable, or walking on the sidewalk with a sign that says "I'm for Jones" is not an alternative to putting a sign up on your lawn, it's very hard, I think, to see how the Paula Deen network can possibly be an alternative to Facebook. It's a completely different form of communication. And so
or WRAL, because actually WRAL requires one to have a Facebook account in order to post a comment.
Well, that's also an unfortunate. That's right. But right, the notion that WRAL is a substantial alternative to the New York Times and the Washington Post, which are prohibited sites, I think does real damage to the notion of what it means to provide alternatives. And we're hoping that the court would see this as an opportunity to bring a little more clarity to the notion of how you do this analysis of what constitutes a real alternative that is still open to you. In our view, this statute leaves virtually nothing available in terms, the critical public communication platforms of our time are closed to registered sex offenders because of this statute. We've just gone through a political campaign which has been conducted almost exclusively on Twitter, as far as I could tell, and to say that, well, it's okay if you can't participate in Twitter because you can use some other network, is frankly preposterous. And we're hoping that the court sees this as an opportunity to clarify that prong of this analysis.
All right. Well, thanks, David. Those are my questions, Larry. I want to give Ms. Gail an opportunity to pose some questions of her own, so I'm going to turn it back over to you, Larry.
Thank you, and Barbara. Feel free before we go to general. We're going to get to the listeners out there in a few minutes. But Barbara,
I just have a couple, and I hope my grandchildren don't interrupt. Professor Post, I think there might be some folks out there that don't understand what an amicus brief is. That's sort of a legal term that a lot of our listeners might not have a clue what we're talking about. Could you explain
that? Sure. I'd be happy to. Amicus curiae brief is a friend of the court. And what it means simply is, it is a procedure through which anyone is permitted at least to ask to be allowed to speak to the court, even if they have no stake in the litigation. In fact, those who specifically don't have a stake in the litigation are allowed to submit their views to the court just as a friend of the court, typically on behalf of one side or the other, or taking the side of one side or the other, but not affiliated with the parties in any way. Just saying, one of the things you do in an amicus brief is the first thing you say is, here's who we are and why we are participating in this action. So in the amicus brief at the Supreme Court, there's a short statement that says, we're law professors, we're interested in the First Amendment, we think it's very important, we write about it and talk about it all the time, and we think that an issue of great importance is raised by this case, and we wanted to bring it to the court's attention. And that's really all it is. It can be a very effective, I've participated in maybe a dozen or more of these over the past 5 or 10 years. Mostly in my, I do a lot of copyright work, quite apart from this constitutional work. And it's a very effective way for people like law professors to have an impact on the court, to sort of address directly something a court is considering, and it's often a very effective means to sort of marshal support for a particular position.
And so are you saying that the courts give good credence to amicus briefs that are filed?
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you what happens. In a case like this, when there's an amicus brief that comes in with a cert petition at the court, that usually means they'll at least take a close look at it. If you know, a bunch of law professors think this is worth looking at, it's worth looking at. You know, I mean, they'll give it a little attention. You know, these cert petitions are read by clerks in the first instance, and they see that there's an amicus brief from a bunch of law professors, some of whom they may know of or have heard of, and they say, okay, that something must be going on here. Let's at least take a look at this. This is not the remember. There are thousands of these that come in. They come in waves, week after week after week. And it gets you to the top of the pile to see that there's a cert petition, that there's an amicus brief, because that's unusual. Most cert petitions do not come with amicus briefs attached. Now, if the court accepts a case, if the court says, yes, we're going to hear this case, then the amicus briefs come in droves. I mean, every case the court hears will have a dozen or more different amicus briefs on either side.
Who would file those?
Trade associations, for example, on both sides, unions, corporate groups, you know, the whoever has typically an economic interest in the litigation on either side. Independent companies will file on their own behalf and say, we don't like this regulation, we agree with the challenge because it's blah, 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 blah. And the public interest community is very active in that. The ACLU files amicus briefs. The Electronic Frontier Foundation files amicus briefs all the time, one after another. Those can be very helpful, very influential. They can also be completely useless and a waste of everybody's time and money. When I was a clerk, I can tell you I read amicus briefs in both categories. A lot of times they just repeat what the lawyers have already said. The lawyers for the parties have already made their arguments, and then the amicus brief comes in and it says the same thing. And that's just an effort for the internal politics. You know, the National Association of Manufacturers will say, we're going to submit an amicus brief on some because we think it's important. And they just do it to do it. And it doesn't have any new information in it. Sometimes the amicus, there's almost an amicus campaign. A really good lawyer who has a case at the Supreme Court will try to organize the amicus briefs so that they cover different points. You'll have the ACLU raising some First Amendment issue. You'll have the Chamber of Commerce raising an issue under the Commerce Clause. You'll have you'll try to sort of marshal your troops. It's perfectly appropriate to do that. It is not appropriate to pay the amicus to be an amicus. That's not permitted by the rules. For the parties to reimburse the amicus for anything. But you're allowed to talk to them and plan out strategy, and they do that all the time. And that can be very, very effective.
I wanted to ask, you made a comment about the Paula Deen Network not allowing folks under 18. How do they police that? How do they know?
This has come up. One of the cases... I should mention this. I think that the best argument that we have before the Supreme Court that they should take this case is that several other federal courts have looked at the social networking prohibitions and have struck them down. Nebraska There's a Doe versus Nebraska case in which the was struck down. Doe versus Jindal in Louisiana struck them down, and Marion County in Indiana struck them down. So we have a real, I think that there's a real split. And one of the things in all of those other cases that the court did focus on was the fact that, well, nobody really has an effective means of policing internet sites to
right.
determine whether or not minors are present. So what this really means, if you really took this seriously, the Nebraska statute said something like that sex offenders were not allowed to access sites that were accessible by persons under the age of 18. And the court quite rightly said, you know, if we take that seriously, that's the whole internet. That's everything that is out there. That is virtually a prohibition on internet access of any kind. Because nobody has a good way, with the exception of some sites can, you know, the one way that you can do age verification reasonably efficiently is through credit cards. Not perfect, but it's a lot of sites use that. And there's some small proportion of sites that, in fact, will not let you access unless you have provided a valid credit card as a means of, but the Paula D Network may do that for all I know. I don't know. But that's one way you can be reasonably certain. It's obviously, you know, that kids can get their parents' credit cards. It's
sure.
known to happen. But that's a reasonable way to at least try to ensure. But very few sites, actually, you know, that's a less than 0.1% or something of the total number of sites that are out there. So you would really be talking about, you know, the internet is accessible to persons under the age of 18, almost everything on it. And if you're trying to keep sex offenders out of those sites, what you are in effect saying is you can't use the internet, and that's too broad, they said, quite appropriately. That's way beyond what you need to do in order to do whatever it is you're trying to do with these statutes.
I read an article in The Week magazine that stated, and I don't have it in front of me, so I can't give you the quote, that had recently determined that the internet is a utility, just like the telephone,
yeah.
water, electricity, gas, that sort of thing. Does that determination help at all in saying this is, you know, this is something
yeah.
that everybody ought to be able to, you know, to have?
Yeah, I think what helps more than that. Because I think that case was actually really treating it as a utility. I mean, it was about sort of the sort of regulatory model
mm-hmm.
That we would use, and that's a little bit. I think what helped. I think the spirit of that is useful, and I think more to the point are sort of declarations by courts around the world now. There's a European Court of justice decision that says it's a basic fundamental right to be on the internet. There are some courts in the United States that have gone that far, that says it is a constitutionally protected right, part of the bundle of human rights that everybody has to communicate with others. And these days that means to have access to the internet. And I think that this case is an outlier. This North Carolina case is really an outlier. We've had good success, as I said, in the other cases, in Nebraska and the other cases, or in California, arguing that you cannot prohibit these individuals from internet use broadly, because that is, in this day and age, consigning them to a certain class citizenship, and it's hard to get a job or get an apartment or to meet your friends or run for office or talk about politics or get your news or get your entertainment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, without internet access these days. And that's sort of part of what I think the First Amendment should be protecting, is your right to receive that information. And I think we've had some reasonably good success. This case really stands out, I think, as quite extraordinary. And I should say there were two justices on the North Carolina court who wrote dissents in this case that were stinging, as they say. I mean, they leveled all barrels at the majority here, and I thought to very good effect. That will help also, by the way, in terms of convincing the Supreme Court that this is a case they might want to hear, to have two strong, well-written dissents from the North Carolina Supreme Court helps, because it shows that there really is something, there's something going on here. There's another side to this. To this case.
We find with so many of the sex offenders who are clients, friends, family, whatever, that they are prohibited by parole or probation from accessing the internet, and they also cannot go to the library, and so they are totally denied information that is out there for the world. And so this is particularly interesting to us and important to us to see if that might trickle down to bring about some changes on our local levels all across the country.
Yeah. No, I think it is really an important it's an important issue. I say it's not the end of the world if the Supreme Court decides not to hear this case. You know, it's only I recognize for people in North Carolina it is a very serious matter, and it's a terrible thing. But it is only North Carolina, and there will be other chances, I think, to get them to look at this issue at some point, because I think it really is quite it's quite debilitating, and I think it's important for other. I've tried to make the case with colleagues and at conferences and all that this is not just about sex offenders. This is about everybody. I mean, what do we have the First Amendment right to? Do I, David Post, I'm not a registered sex offender, do I have a First Amendment right to access the internet? I think I damn well should and do.
Sure.
But these cases call that, case like this North Carolina case calls that into question, as to how substantial really that right is. And I think that's problematic, quite apart from the context of these cases, but for other things that the government may be trying to do.
Sure. And I would probably add, just of my own opinion, and I'm going to turn it back over to Larry after this, but I think there are probably a ton of more states that have the same problem, and we are just hopeful that this case will be heard and will perhaps provide some guidance for some of our local judges. And Larry, after that, I'm going to turn it back over to you. And thank you so much, Professor, for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Barbara. We are nearing the hour of this segment, so unfortunately we're not going to have much time for questions. If Janice, I don't see her on the console anymore, but if Janice is here and she wants to ask a question or say anything before we go to the next segment, I would appreciate hearing from her. But I think we're going to have to leave it at the presentation after Janice. Did you have anything you want to ask Professor Post?
Not at this point. I really appreciate your input there, David. I'd love to talk to you separately about our AML case, but given the time, I think I'm going to bow out.
I'd be happy to talk. Shoot me an email. You know how to reach me, and we can talk about that. But
Thank you.
Thank you for what you guys are doing. We could have asked a ton more questions, and there's always people out there who have questions. It's not the end of the world if this cert petition is not granted, but it could be the beginning of something good if it is granted.
Yeah. Let me just end by saying this. I was involved over the last 5-6 years in a completely separate set of cases involving. You may have read about it. What's called civil forfeiture. It's all over the country. the police were using these various forfeiture laws that allowed them to seize property of people who were stopped for motor vehicle violations or who, minor drug offenses, and the police could seize their houses, and it was of epidemic proportions, and it was unconscionable. And there was a sort of a movement started to oppose that. And there were a few cases that were filed, and we won some, and we lost some, and there was articles in the New York Times, and the New Yorker picked it up, and there was a lot of press coverage, and finally the Supreme Court got involved in some cases, and the tide turned. I think it's not that the problem has disappeared, but it is coming under control. The Attorney General has called for some new regulations about civil forfeiture, and this issue about the sex offender registries, I must say, it feels a little bit to me like that, that the tide is turning. It takes a while. This is a very slow-moving ship that we have, the ship of state, and it doesn't turn on a dime, but I sort of feel the same way about this. It looks to me like the civil forfeiture stuff looked 4 or 5 years ago. The press coverage is taking a different tone these days. There's an increasing, I think, realization in the public that these statutes are not working and they're punitive and they don't do what they're supposed to do, and they do more harm than good. And I think, and this might be a part of that, if we can get the court to say something to that effect, that would be great. If we don't do it in this case, we'll do it in some other case. But I do think that the tide is turning on these, we'll keep on working.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We are going to...
My pleasure.
Hope to see you in Atlanta.
Yep. Larry, yeah, this is Brenda. I was wondering if we wanted to address the one question that came on right before we started the meeting about the a private entity and how whether there would really be any effect if Facebook.
Sure, if you can give a brief answer to that. The question was. This is a governmental regulation, but since Facebook has, many of the social networks have their own policies, will this impact those entities, and what would be the next step to try to influence their policies?
I think the answer is that's a very good question. I think the answer to that is it won't affect their policies. That is, whatever the First Amendment protections are that we can get a court to declare in a case like this, it won't affect a private entity's right to throw people off the service, to put in their terms of service, as I believe Facebook has in its terms of service, that sex offenders are not to set up accounts on the site. But I think it will have, remember what happened when Facebook, a month ago, there were reports that Facebook was in its news feed, in choosing what stuff to push out in its news feed, it was favoring more liberal political the politics than conservative politics. And there was a big to-do about that, and hearings were held in Congress, and they swore right, left, and center that they wouldn't do that. Now, they are allowed to do that. If Facebook wants to only push left-wing propaganda in its newsfeed, it is perfectly free to do that because it is a private entity, and the First Amendment does not constrain it. But it responds very much to sort of social pressure. It's aware, the reason it came down to Washington to testify and it was worried about that was because it didn't want to be seen as doing something that the public wouldn't like. And I think as part of, I think, a broader kind of social awareness program, as the public begins to sour a little bit on these registry statutes, hopefully the people in charge at Facebook will relax their standards, their access prohibitions. I know that there are people inside Facebook who are concerned about this, who are not happy, not particularly happy that they have this provision, if only because it covers so many people nowadays, that, you know, they're turning people away, and that's not good for business. They don't like to do that. And they are, I think there are some people in Facebook who are genuinely seeking a way to sort of relax that, but that's a sort of internal Facebook matter that it's hard to get any traction on or any to have any influence over how they run their business.
Well, thank you for that.
Hope that's helpful. Sure,
that is helpful. We're going to divide up the remaining time here, and we've got at least three things. I only received one request from a state to give a report, so if there are any other state reports, you better press *6. Otherwise, we only have one. We have International Megan's Law, and we have National Conference. So we need to divide up the time because I don't want to go too much past an hour and a half before we conclude. So how much time do you need, Janice? How much time does Andy need for your Georgia report? And I know Brenda will need about 5 minutes for National Conference. So,
I put Andy's the only one left that's muted himself. I had to, so I've got to unmute Janice again. Hang on.
Yeah. So.
Sorry. Okay. Great.
I only need a handful of minutes. I don't know. It's probably less than 5 minutes.
So okay. Well then.
I appreciate Tim. This is Janice.
Janice, how much time do you need?
10 minutes. She said.
Okay, I didn't hear. Apologize. Okay,
sorry.
So we've got a lot of people that would always want to know about International Megan's Law, and we've got 10 minutes for International Megan's Law update of the status, and then Barbara Gale is going to guide that part of the discussion, and then we're going to go to Georgia, and then the conference, National Conference. Brenda, the National Conference, we will send out a follow-up email about the National Conference, so if we end up having to cut that short, we'll add that into the follow-up email.
Sure enough. So, we did get one person pressing *6, so we do have
Was that for another state report?
Yes, I'm sure it is, since you asked for that specifically.
Okay, well, what state is that, and how much time do they need?
Let's just unmute him or her.
Oh, hey, gang. My name is Guy Hamilton Smith. I'm in Kentucky, and I didn't know exactly what you were looking for, but I do. There are some developments in Kentucky along these lines. Kentucky
okay,
statutes.
We'll have you follow Andy and we're going to go International Megan's Law. And then Georgia, and then Kentucky, and then the National Conference.
Absolutely.
So
okay.
So Barbara, you're in charge now. Barbara,
okay.
Janice.
She may have to unmute herself. I don't think I muted. Maybe I did mute her. Hold on. Sorry, Barbara. I think I muted you again. There you go.
Are we both on?
Yeah, you're here again now. Sorry about that.
That's okay. Tell us where the case is now.
Sure. I just want a reminder that we filed a motion for preliminary injunction, and
mm-hmm.
that was we argued the motion in late March, and it was denied in April. And the reason it was denied really was procedural, and that was the judge ruled that the case was not ripe, and also that the plaintiffs lack standing. And the federal government followed up with that ruling and filed a motion to dismiss the entire case based on the same two grounds. Again, that it wasn't ripe and that the plaintiffs lack standing. So we've exchanged all the briefs that have to be exchanged, And the weird thing that happened in this case is there's quite a pause between us filing all the written documents, and we have oral arguments, not for another month, until July 27th. So we will be in Oakland on that day. I looked at the judge's calendar a couple days ago, and at that point in time, she has no other motions being argued that day, so it looks like we might have her full attention on that day. I don't think that will change as far as how long it takes for oral arguments. I think we'll still only get an hour. And I'm not optimistic. I think that there's a good chance that the judge will grant the government's motion to dismiss the case. Having said that, that doesn't mean it's over.
What happens then? What happens if the judge agrees and dismisses the government, grants the government's motion?
Well, if she grants the dismissal based upon procedural grounds, and again, either ripeness or the standing of the plaintiffs or both, then our decision is whether or not to appeal her decision to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And I'm not inclined to do that because if the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals were to agree with us, and that would be the best case scenario, the case would be sent back to the same judge. And she's already not sympathetic. And if she gets overturned by the Ninth Circuit, I think she would be even less sympathetic. And then to get a decision from her on the merits that would be adverse would not be a good thing. Though, of course, we could take that back up to the Ninth Circuit. So we're looking at the possibility, and, of course, this is a contingency planning because we don't know what actually will happen. But our contingency planning is actually to consider waiting a few months and filing a brand new lawsuit and file it probably down in Los Angeles in the Central District. So unlike many states, California has four district courts in California. So the Central District is in L.A. We filed it originally in Northern District, hoping we would get a liberal judge in San Francisco, but instead we got a very conservative judge in Oakland. And there aren't even that many judges in Oakland. So, supposedly this is done by lottery and everything's fine. Who knows if that's true? And I don't just put that out there for this case, but for all cases about the system. I know how it's supposed to work, and then you always wonder how it actually does work. So if it does go to Los Angeles, the trigger we would be waiting for, and this is so the government's argument about this case is not ripe, would disappear, and that is we would wait for the draft regulations to be issued by the Department of State about what the unique identifier is going to look like and where it's going to be put on somebody's passport. And I think that was not a valid argument by the government, but my opinion doesn't count.
Right.
And, as I argued during oral argument in March, that it doesn't make any difference what that unique identifier looks like or where it's put on the passport, just its mere existence on your passport could, in fact, bring undue attention and quite frankly, violate the Constitution. So I have heard some very informal reports. There is a gentleman, for example, who traveled abroad, and he was told by the State Department, and I have the email that was sent to him, that an endorsement was going to be added to his passport saying that he was a sex offender. And, that was alarming because the federal government has said consistently in their written briefs and during oral argument that nothing was going to happen until the end of the calendar year. As far as I know, that didn't happen. He successfully traveled to that country, which is a very small island in Micronesia, I believe it is, or Marshall Islands. We've had a few conversations, for lack of a better term, by text message, and I know he made it there. So he's, of course, concerned about getting back, but I think for most of our registrants, it's really not, the United States is not a problem getting back into the country. The U.S. is going to let people get back into the country. Really, the biggest problem, as far as I can see it, is gaining entry into a foreign country.
Do you have any way of knowing when they're going to come up with those regulations, the draft regulations?
Well, They said they were going to do it in the fourth quarter of this calendar year. So fourth quarter starts on October 1. One thing I've been trying to get a hold of, and I have asked my opposing counsel on the case informally, is to provide me with a copy of a report that the executive branch was supposed to hand to Congress no later than May 9th. So I don't know if the report hasn't been created and sent, or if I'm just being stonewalled by my opposing counsel, but supposedly that report was going to be an implementation plan. But in the motion for preliminary injunction, one of the declarations filled out by one of the government officials said, again, that they would have this figured out by fourth quarter of this calendar year.
So it's the waiting game.
It is. And I just don't think people are acting honestly. Again, it doesn't really make any difference what that unique identifier is that gets added to a passport.
Right.
It could be anything. It doesn't make any difference where it's going to be added. And for example, when a gentleman told me about, this endorsement on the endorsement pages, I didn't even know our passports had endorsement pages. So I had to go look.
Right.
And sure enough, at the back of people's passports, and if you all are curious, you might go look and see that indeed we all have endorsement pages at the toward the back of our passport. How somebody would be know to go look at your endorsement pages, I really don't know. Another call that I've gotten just recently was a gentleman who tried to travel to Mexico and was turned around. And his story was, he said he was standing in line to go through immigration, and he'd been in line for about 10 minutes. It looked like he had about 10 more minutes to go, and that he was approached by three people, that two of them were wearing government uniforms and one of them was plain clothes, and that they knew exactly who he was when he was standing in line. And his question was, and I could not answer it, was there something in his passport, like a microchip, that helped identify him while he was standing in line? I don't know.
How scary is that?
Very.
So now you're just really waiting, just waiting.
Yeah, we're waiting, Gail, but I will say, in addition, we're planning a protest. And
sure.
So, on July 27th in Oakland, we are going to have a protest. We were planning to have a protest in March and didn't realize quite what the rules were to have a protest. We know what the rules are. We'll dot all the I's and cross all the T's so that we will, in fact, have a protest. Last time what happened, despite the fact we didn't have a formal protest, I was interviewed on the local Fox channel by a radio station, a couple of newspapers. So we still got publicity last time. But this time we have banners we didn't get to use last time. We have signs, we have stickers to put on and things. We've also been considering whether or not to wear armbands in the courtroom. And we
have you
made
been
a decision
contacted
about that.
By any other potential plaintiffs to join the case?
Yes, I have. I have. And I actually think we have great plaintiffs right now. It's disheartening when the attorney that you're opposing is not being honest,
sure.
I think, and forthcoming.
Sure.
And so, for example, one of the plaintiffs, and the current plaintiffs in the lawsuit, who was born in Iran, who came to the United States when he was 8 years old, has lived in this country ever since. His parents had divorced, and his dad is still in Iran, and he wants to go back to visit his father. His father's elderly, and he'd like to visit him while he's still alive. And then the other thing is, after his father's death, he is the sole heir to his father's wealth, whatever that is. And in order, by Iranian law, for him to get his bequest, that he would in fact have to appear in person. And he said that if in fact a notification is sent to Iran or his passport were to be stamped that he'd been convicted of a sex offense, he would be murdered. And so, here this man would have to choose between being killed, because it's a capital punishment in Iran for a sex offense. And, you know, to see his dad before he dies or to go, you know, claim his inheritance after his father dies and have to make such a question. And, you know, when the opposing counsel made her oral argument, she said he lacked standing in the case because his father wasn't dead yet.
And oh, my that goodness.
Yeah, it was that lack of integrity that's troubling.
Well, I appreciate your explanations, Janet. Larry, is there something? I think that covered my questions. Do you have anything else? Or Brenda?
Well, I don't. I think it's a pretty good indication of what we expect when we fight any government entity, particularly the resources of the federal government. They're gonna give it every ounce of energy they can muster. So we will certainly keep tracking this. And Janice, thank you, and we'll be looking forward to hearing from you again. Hopefully, we can have you on before the national conference to build up our massive attendance.
Yes. Well, I am planning to be a speaker at the national conference.
One
have volunteered.
So,
great.
You're welcome.
So July 27th in Oakland.
Yes, and I hope that others will come join us. I know a couple of groups already have said they're going to come join us, like WAR, and I'm forgetting who else. But anyway, other groups are welcome.
So,
it is a national issue.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
All right. So,
thank you.
Thank you, Janice.
You're welcome.
So we got two more reports, actually three more reports: Georgia, Kentucky, and national conference. And so we do five, and five. We'll just be a few minutes over our allotted hour and a half. So, Georgia, you're up. Welcome to Andy
Excellent.
Stein. Thank you for patiently waiting and for your work that you're doing for us on the national conference, as well as organizing Georgia, helping organize Georgia.
Well, thank you, Larry. I appreciate it. As Larry said, my name is Andy Stein, and I work closely with Georgia RSOL and Barbara Gale. we've begun investigating a violation of the liberties of registrants. Judges are stepping outside of their authority and issuing orders. They are effectively writing law, which would be the job of legislators, not judges. And what the law states is it's law number 17-10-1, active probation supervision shall terminate in all cases no later than 2 years from the commencement of active probation supervision unless specifically extended or reinstated by the sentencing court upon notice and hearing and for good cause shown, provided, however, that in those cases involving the collection of fines, restitution, and some other things. What it says in short is that after you've been on probation for 2 years, that should all stop unless you have fines or whatever left over. And what is important then is, what does unsupervised probation mean? And just below where the law states, it says that unsupervised probation means the period of a probated sentence that follows active probation supervision in which all of the conditions and limitations imposed by the court remain intact. A probationer may have reduced reporting requirements, and a community supervision officer shall not actively supervise such a probationer. There are approximately 15,000 registrants in Georgia. Subtracting the ones that have been on probation for less than 2 years, you'd have a pretty large number of people that this would have a positive impact. There are multiple judges in the state that have taken it upon themselves to circumvent and overrule this law. They are writing standing orders that state the registrants are prevented from being removed from supervised probation. We have a copy of one of the standing orders, but reports from all corners of the state confirm that this is happening elsewhere as well. The standing order reads, it further appears to the court that those probationers sentenced for sex offenses as designated by Georgia statute pose a risk and threat to society, a risk and a threat to the victims of these crimes, and a risk and threat to a large class of potential victims. So that's what the law states and what the judges are issuing. We have confirmed from both practicing lawyers and those with law degrees and just legal experts that this is about as black and white as it can be, and the judges are clearly overstepping their authority. And fortunately, yesterday, we received a correspondence from the Georgia Justice Project. They contacted Barbara Gale, who's the co-chair, and they were inquiring to us about how they might be able to help. It's really exciting, and especially since we only contacted them last week. And that's my update.
Well, fantastic. Does that mean that there's potential of litigation? Because I've discussed this with you guys directly, but for the benefit of the audience, does this mean that you guys are seriously considering bringing some legal pressure to the courts who are disregarding the law?
I would like to yield to Barbara. Yes, please.
I might answer that. And when I received the call from the Georgia Justice Project, they asked if we were asking them to file a mandamus action against the Department of Community Supervision, which means an action that would force them to go along with the law that is in place rather than making up their own laws. And he wanted a copy of the standing orders, which Andy sent him, and now I'm just waiting to hear back from him. But I'm really excited.
So, well, that would be the proper vehicle for initiating such an action. If an administrative agency is doing something it's not allowed to do or refusing to do something it's required to do, the vehicle that would be filed would be a petition for a writ of mandamus. So it sounds like you guys are on the right track, and we could be hearing something from Georgia maybe by as early as the conference, which is in Atlanta.
Exciting.
And here's my plug for the national conference.
Very exciting.
Shameless plug.
So okay. Well, that was 5 minutes, Andy.
He did so, well.
Yes. That, thank you.
So, in Kentucky, see if you can keep yours to 5 minutes.
Okay. All right. 5 minutes. I'm on. So, my name is Guy Hamilton Smith, and I work with a group called Kentucky Citizens and Families for Reform. That's a state affiliate of National RSOL. And just a couple things to touch on. One of them was that, given the subject matter of the call, Kentucky actually has a series of statutes that bar anyone on the registry from using any type of social media or instant messaging program that anyone under the age of 18 can access, as well as requiring advanced registration of any online identifiers. And we're actually heavily involved in federal civil rights litigation right now that's pending in the Eastern District of Kentucky in federal court. And we're essentially just waiting on a decision. All the briefs have been submitted. Professor Post was actually one of our expert witnesses in the case. And so we're essentially waiting on a decision that we anticipate will be favorable because Kentucky statutes are in many ways much more restrictive than the ones that were issued in Packingham or some of the other federal decisions on this particular issue. So, as I said, I work with Kentucky Citizens and Families for Reform. It's been around for a little while, but we've just recently, I guess, started to get more wind under our sails, you might say, and there's several of us, and we're getting organized and incorporated as a 501c3 and a 501c4. And I've recently made our first foray into legislative lobbying, where this past legislative session in Kentucky, there was a bill that we were able to successfully stop in the state Senate that would have made registration much more onerous in a number of different domains. But as I said, we were able to get it killed in the state Senate. So we are, we're currently in the process of sort of preparing for the upcoming legislative session and also awaiting a decision on, this federal lawsuit that's pending, which if we win, if we lose, we're certainly going to appeal to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. If we win, then I would imagine that the Kentucky Attorney General would probably appeal it, even if it's a dead loser. So we've got a few things going on in Kentucky, and I think that's just about it. I think I got 3 minutes, so I think that's about all I got.
Well, that's a really concise report, and kudos to Kentucky.
Sorry, go ahead.
I didn't even realize you guys were so active.
Yeah, like I said, the KYCFR, they had been around for a while, but it's really a person named Jennifer Van Wees. It's sort of her baby, but she had had difficulty, I guess, finding people who were willing to kind of put in the work, and she kind of got linked up with me and a few other people and who are willing to roll our sleeves up and get our hands dirty. And so we're here in the bluegrass being a royal pain in the ass in any way we can.
Well, that is really, really exciting, and look forward to having you back on regularly for updates. We're trying to develop this so that states will be reporting. It's inspirational for people to hear what's going on in other states, because they feel like that it's a losing cause and that mm-hmm. nothing's happening positive. So that's one of my purposes for these calls, is to try to make sure the states realize, in addition to what we do on our internal listserv, that the people who are supporting us across the country realize that there's action going on in other states. So that's
that's a great idea. Yeah, and I certainly plan to be back. So. I'll keep you all posted about what's going on here.
So, amazingly, Brenda, we have not had any attrition on this call. We've been about the same level. This has been a very college-type law school class tonight, and I was expecting a lot of hang-ups, but we've had very little, so we're almost at the same level we were throughout the call. So you've got to full... audience to make your pitch about the national conference, and if there are a few questions, I don't mind taking a few questions, but everyone's gone, so it'll just be me and Robin and Barbara. But let's do the national conference and get people excited about being at Atlanta in 85 days.
I think we may have Janice may have popped on to do a state report. At least I'm guessing that. Do you want to tuck that in there in another 5 minutes, specifically on the state?
If Janice has a state report, we'd be delighted to hear it.
I think that's what it is, so let's just see here if I'm there we go. I think I've got you, Janice. Are you off now?
Yeah, I'm here, Brenda. Yes, I was just inspired by Kentucky to report on something that happened in the California legislature just this morning. So I was testifying before our Assembly's Public Safety Committee on one bill when another bill popped up. And it's something that, quite frankly, we had left to the ACLU and I'll just say the big boys to weigh in on, and they lost big time. And that is, we have a bill that would eliminate, and I do mean eliminate, the statutes of limitations for major sex offenses, including rape. And we had Gloria Allred testified today in front of our state legislature, and it was not pretty. And everybody, and they also brought in four victims of Bill Cosby. And so this was the second body of our state legislature that approved this bill, and it's hard to believe that it's going and moving so quickly, but we have a very heavily awaited Democratic state legislature, and it's making no difference. So usually they're the ones that would put the brakes on things like this, but they are not. And so I'm just kind of a warning out to other state legislatures, and maybe if it's late enough in the season, you're not going to have to worry about this. But this is something that just came about very quickly. It was almost like a tsunami wave, and it only has to go to the floor to be passed in the Assembly. And I guess, again, it's the second house in our state legislature to pass it. And then the only other possibility is if the governor vetoes it. But,
Janice, that's a trend across the country that's been underway, and it's gaining momentum, eliminating the statute of limitations, where the victims' advocates are coming in with heavy ammo, as you just described, saying that all these cases with advances of forensic science, these cases have been solved, but there's no justice because of, like in Dennis Hastert's case. So this is going to be a very difficult freight train to stop.
Absolutely, and that's very frightening. And we did have ACLU, you know, testify against it, and they have an organization called California Attorneys for Criminal Justice that, you know, spoke against it, but they got mowed down. And people, even on that committee, that are usually broad-minded and liberal thinkers, they just passed it unanimously.
I mean, look at that 1.6 million signatures on the recall petition. I mean, it's just a mob mentality right now with this issue. So,
yes.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Okay, Brenda, sell a bunch of conference tickets tonight, will you?
Sell a bunch of conference tickets. Well, I thought I would just start with, in my very short chunk of time, to just go ahead and tell you who we have lined up right now. Janice has already mentioned that she's going to be there, and I believe the topic is it only takes one person. That sounds very inspirational. We are going to have Catherine Carpenter. So some folks who've been around a while will
Professor
recognize
Catherine Carpenter.
Yes, I'm only using first and last names. My bad. But yes, Professor Catherine Carpenter, she's a vice dean and a law professor at Southwestern Law School, and she's a returning speaker. She was with us when we were in California for the conference, and she's going to be back. She was definitely the hit of the show then, talking about the Adam Walsh Act, I believe, and you can still find her video so you can see how she was back then. We'll have Ben LaBranche. It's spelled more like it's French. And he's an attorney from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and has been working for many years as a public defender and others, and we'll be discussing criminal defense issues. We don't have topics for everybody yet. They're still submitting those. We're going to have Craig Bennett Hallenstein. He's a psychologist and an author. The book in particular that caught our eye was The Dolphin. And he wrote this book about someone who was, a fictional book about someone who was convicted of a sex offense and the struggles that person has. And he's going to be there talking, of course, a little about his book, but also just about situations in general. And currently on the list of our main speakers is John Duard. I believe that's the correct pronunciation. And he is also a defense attorney from New Jersey. And we'll be discussing the dehumanization, I think, talking about dehumanization, other things like that. Again, we're still kind of working on topics. So there's just a little hint. You can actually read their full bios. I was doing a capsule version, but you can read their bios on the National Conference website, which is rsolconference.org. And the speakers are a separate tab there. And then, of course, you can go and sign up for the conference. We hope you'll be there. It's September 16th through the 18th. And you can, if you show up the evening before, there'll be a meet and greet on the 15th. But we don't count that. It's free. And so it's the 16th through the 18th of September in Atlanta, Georgia. So there's my quick overview of the speakers coming up. And we hope that'll wet your whistle and get you interested in signing up to attend.
We haven't said a whole lot about workshops, but I do have one workshop that's going to be a great one, and that's the federal probation
in North
Georgia has mm-hmm. agreed that they will provide a presenter regarding federal probation and supervised release, general supervision, and more specifically focused on sex offenders and what they require. And a lot of people want to know if they can do this and why do they do this. And so I was shocked when they said yes, that they would send someone. So it'll be a Q&A interactive, but they won't be able to dissect everybody's individual case. But it'll be a workshop. I've seen them do that in Philadelphia at the National Defense Lawyers Meeting. They provided a probation officer to help the lawyers, help the defense bar understand and it was great. So that was where the idea came from. So
excellent. Yeah, thank you. I didn't touch on the workshops yet, but that I know that's breaking news. We just got that info today. So very exciting.
So all right, and so we still have people on here.
We do.
Hey, can you guys still hear me?
You are still there, Robin.
Let's put a bit of a plug in for next month's RSOL in action.
Yeah.
Which right now we've got scheduled for July the 14th, I believe, where we're going to have Paul Dubeling. I have a hard time. I've never actually heard his last name pronounced, but it's spelled Dubbeling. He is the chief counsel in the Doe's v. Cooper case, which is also another North Carolina case dealing with the premises statute, in which Judge Beatty, Middle District Federal Judge, in April, struck down most of the statute, and that statute's on appeal now to the Fourth Circuit, or the case is on appeal to the Fourth Circuit. So anyway, he's going to be with us, and that should also be a pretty good topic for discussion, so please tune back in next month.
When you say
so, Robin,
premises,
that premises, but that's like residency restriction? Is that
no,
the way of thinking?
No. It's not residency. It's actually premises, meaning where registrants can and cannot go.
Okay.
Not
where they can live. Okay. Yeah. I frequently will call that proximity, but it sounds like you're talking more specifically than proximity.
Yeah,
you're talking a building or a playground or a.
Well, yeah.
It's the name of the statute here. They actually call it the premises statute. So that's
gotcha.
Why
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Matter of fact, Robin and I were working on a case where a guy was prosecuted for being at McDonald's. Because they have a playground on the premises. And as a result of Judge Beatty, that his prosecution was quashed. But yes, that is going to be exciting, and we'll have a lot of questions. Hopefully, we can get some questions in next time, because there are going to be people wanting to know how that is going to affect them in other states, and then is it going to affect people on probation or parole? I can tell that one's coming.
great. So, yeah, thanks for reminding us about that, Robin.
And,
Larry would have said something.
Did you want to plug your call 1 week from tonight?
Yeah, if I don't draw a complete blank. let's see. That's coming a week from tonight. And who do we have on there? I am, in fact, pulling a old-timers session.
Well, if you've got old-timers, that's all right. But I can tell you what you got on the Internet, if that's sufficient.
Yes, please remind me, because I am literally drawing a total blank on the name and the topic.
Well, it deals with risk assessments. Dr. Randall Wallace, licensed
there
psychologist.
There you go. Thank you.
Certified polygraph examiner will present the fundamentals of assessment of risk of sexual recidivism. And
Risk assessments
will be exciting to talk about, and there will be people who will want to know what it has to do with their situation and how it works. Some states mm-hmm. base their registration requirements on an actual risk assessment, but practically every state does some risk assessment for supervisory levels and for how the judge is going to sentence the person. So that should be a good conversation next week with.
I do believe it is, and he's got a wealth of experience and background in it, and should be able to speak very knowledgeably as to the different types of assessments and the value of combining versus just having one, and all of that sort of thing. So I think it'll be a good session. Yeah. Thank you for bailing me out there, Larry.
No problem. Well, we've still got people here, so I tell everyone thank you for coming. And I did say I would take a couple of review questions, but if anybody has any, but it's only going to be a couple because I have to get out of here, and I'm going to drop off after one question.
We do have one that just came in then. Oops, and I even unmuted them really quickly.
I just asked a question. Mm-hmm. Can I just quickly ask you a question?
Yes, ma'am.
Who are you directing it to?
Excuse me?
Who do you want to direct the question to?
Well, in general, about your conference. I'm calling
sure.
from Virginia. I recently retired as a clinical psychologist. I have a son serving a 6.5-year sentence for possession of child pornography. He's considered a violent sex offender. Now, having never touched a child, I would like to become more active in your organization. I am wondering, does it serve you if I come? I'm 78 years old. If I come to Atlanta, is that a good way to put my time and money into your organizations, or are they different ways where I can be active and useful? I have read your brochure. I'm very... I have done research on child pornography. There is a lot going on in Germany that is encouraging and so forth. People here are not doing that kind of research. But the question is, how will I help you if I show up in Atlanta?
That's a good question. I think the short answer would be that the help is probably more in what you would benefit from it, because you would get a chance to see and hear from other advocates and other professionals and the research that is being done.
Yes, I'm quite familiar with the research. And people like your lawyer today, he was very informative, but he talked a whole hour, and he talked about a lot of issues that weren't really – I feel frustrated, and I'm grieving for my son. I want to be active in some way. I want to make a difference. Is that good for your organization, for me to come and listen to other people talk, or should I just take the money and send it to you so that you can use it in more – practical ways?
Well, I think if what you're wanting as an individual is to be more active, your best option really would be to sign up as a volunteer and find a particular role within our organization or within your state organization.
We are so backwards.
You do have a state organization there.
I do?
Mm-hmm. You sure do.
Okay. One thing. How do I find out?
I think if you go on the website, they are listed. But if not, certainly just...
on your website?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
If not, they're listed if they're a genuine, full blown organization. But often we have a few volunteers that are together and doing something, not a full blown organization. So if you don't spot us on the website, if I've just lied about that, you can still shoot us a message via our contact form and just say, hey, I want to connect with the people in Virginia. I want to get involved, and we'll connect you up with them.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It may be better if I, sign a check and send it to you as a contribution.
Well, we will never we will never turn down a contribution.
I know,
I
and become
you.
More active, on a local level.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I think the big benefit of a conference is that
it sounds like you have a need for people like on your board with legal background. I'm a clinical psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
That would not be useful to you, would it?
Well, there's a place for any number of things, even on our board and amongst other
mm-hmm.
areas.
Mm-hmm.
So look around on our website. There are volunteer descriptions of roles up there under get involved, and you'll probably, hopefully you'll find something there that piques your interest.
Mm-hmm.
The conference itself would be, again, it's a more of an opportunity for our existing advocates to grow and, get a chance to not feel so isolated, and also to learn how to be better advocates. So there's advantage to that. Exactly. And, so I think connecting somebody like you might want to try to get connected at the state level and see how to get involved there. You'd have a chance to, meet with a few of the folks there in Virginia.
Okay.
I think that would be lovely.
Make you better. Yeah. Okay.
Sure.
You.
I might add, Brenda.
Yeah, I
think it's.
I was dying to ask this already last time when I but didn't
yeah.
get a chance. Okay.
It's a wonderful opportunity to make connections and to learn. I mean, last year was my first conference, and I met so many people, and it gave me information about how I could help. So,
mm-hmm. Where do you live?
I live in Georgia.
Yeah. See, it's a trip, a big trip from
it is
sure.
Yeah.
Virginia
last year it was in Dallas.
Yeah,
to go to Dallas.
Yeah, when I went to Dallas, and I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. Such an opportunity to learn so
yes.
many things. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I'm torn. I'm very torn. So, well, okay.
Yes, it's a big choice. It's a big choice.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you. Yeah, Larry, we do have some other people that came on with questions. I don't know how much time you have.
Well, let's make them quick, folks.
Okay. So anybody else that comes on, you've got exactly. I get a little bit silly, but serious at the same time. You've got 15 seconds to give your question, and then Larry's got 2 minutes to give an answer. How's that? So here's our next person.
Yeah, hi, everyone. My name is Dale. Quick question. I'm still a little confused about this pending Supreme Court case, specifically with the social media. As a professional, I need to use Twitter and LinkedIn in particular. That's how I make my living. So I'm confused about what the impact is in the short term or the long term.
Well, I was going to say that if you don't live in North Carolina, there's no direct impact. But Robert,
yeah.
you want to grab that one?
Well, that's what I was going to say, that the law, unless he's in North Carolina, he shouldn't. Where are you? You're
yeah,
in
California.
California. So, yeah, the law here, of course, has absolutely no effect on you. Am I echoing bad, Brenda?
No, not
okay.
There, but not real bad.
If the court were to take the case, and it's important to put it that way, because at this point the court has not taken the case. The court's simply looking at it, much like a cat might look at some delicious dinner, but then decide to walk away. So the court could say, we've looked it over, we're not going to take it. But if the court were to take it, then the question becomes, what would the decision be? If we get a positive decision, and that varies, it's hard to say whether the decision would be full or narrow. The court would have the full realm of options at its disposal. But let's just assume that the court decides to slap back at the Supreme Court of North Carolina. And even goes further confirms or declares that registrants are entitled to the full protections of the First Amendment. That could have profound effects across the entire country where there are statutes that limit access to social media such as Twitter and Facebook. But if you don't have any restrictions now, then you don't have anything to worry about.
Well, Facebook, of course, has its policy. So I dropped off of Facebook years ago, but I use LinkedIn actively. That's a very important site for my profession in software engineering, and that is a key place for me to network in my profession. And I'm a global engineer. I service customers, and I work for a company that's a global company. So. That taking that away from me would be a serious impact to my ability to make a living.
Certainly.
Well, yep. Well, Robin, wouldn't the counter be if the Supreme Court were to grant the cert petition, hear the case, and were to agree with the North Carolina Supreme Court that this is a reasonable restriction and it's only access rather than speech that's impacted here, which would be a horrible decision in my view if they were to do that. Wouldn't that be a signal to states that don't have restrictions that you can put the pedal to the metal and enact such restrictions because they're okay?
Sure, absolutely, and that's exactly what would happen. So it's a case that has to be kept close eye on because, as Larry points out, if in fact the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, were to take the case and were to affirm North Carolina's decision, then we would go through a fairly difficult period of time as registrants trying to maintain some level of connectivity, and it would have an enormous impact on people who are engaged in business and transactions that require the use of social media to earn their way, earn their living.
Okay. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
I think that's pretty close to 2 minutes. All right, next person.
Hi, Larry. This is Hank.
Hi, Hank.
Is Larry still on the line?
Yes, go ahead, Hank. Hey.
Okay, Janice mentioned this business of an SOL thing being at the assembly. It's been banging around for 6 months. It's a Senate bill, Senate Bill 813. Anyway, Stockner, the SCOTUS-Stockner affects this because you can't go backwards, right?
Did you follow that? Because I didn't follow that, Larry.
No, I'm not clear on the question. It
sounds like you're referring to a particular case.
Well, California versus Stockner back in 2003 was the United States Supreme Court decision saying you can't go backwards. So even if California Senate passes the SB 813, it can only be effective with its start date. Can't go
well,
backwards.
I see what you're saying. He's asking whether or not if they did away with the
statute of limitations,
could they reach back? Could they, in effect, retroactively scoop up all of, for instance, cases that might have occurred in the 60s and 70s and 80s?
Well, I don't know that case, Hank, but what I do know is in our state here of New Mexico that the interpretation of our Supreme Court was that if the statute that was in place had not run at the time they changed it, if it had not run its course, then the change would be fine, because the statute of limitations is not a constitutional protection. It's something we've done as a result of common law passed down through the ages because of the recognition that a person can't adequately defend themselves with the passage of time. Cases deteriorate, memories fade, you know, evidence is lost. There's just no way that what you can defend yourself. But what the California courts would do with an enactment of that statute is it would be speculative in terms of whether they could go backwards. If the statute of limitations had already expired on those offenders and they interpreted it the way New Mexico did, then we wouldn't have any problem. But we don't know how they're going to interpret the statute. And since there's no constitutional provision, that would not be a cert petition that could go to the Supreme Court on that if you disagree with the California Supreme Court, because there's no constitutional guarantee of a statute of limitations. Does that help you?
Sure. When California 2 years ago moved the SOL up to 40 years old, it was only effective as to that day. They couldn't go backwards and say, well, anyway, the Stockner 2003 decision is SCOTUS, and that'll prevent it. But anyway, I just wanted to run it by you. I track this stuff all the time.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Okay, we have one more. No more questions after this, please, because then we definitely need to go at
yeah,
that
we do.
Point.
And the attendance has plummeted, so I think
we're
boring.
Yep, we're all dropping. So here's your last one.
This is Don in South Carolina. I have one other angle to throw in on the Facebook question. Something that has aggravated me considerably is the number of newspapers that now require that you have a Facebook account in order to post comments, and specifically Gannett, which is enormous, and now Scripps are both in this camp, and you are prohibited from expressing yourself in these big forums. I mean, newspapers and comments in newspapers is a pretty critical part of First Amendment, I would think, and free speech. Anybody want to comment on that?
I agree.
Well, I mean, I'm making this case everywhere I can. This is a sort of latent, dormant aspect of this general prohibition that only people who are subjected to it even consider it. Part of what's happening, Don, mostly has to do with economics. The reality is that it's become cheaper and more efficient for media outlets to use this sort of plug-in approach, which is what's happening. so that Facebook handles, you know, the registration stuff, and they don't have to manage vast lists of who's registered to participate in their comments. So, but it's definitely an issue, and as I say, we're pointing this out. I think David, actually, who was on earlier, is much more aware of this phenomenon now than he was, say, 2 or 3 weeks ago. But it's frustrating because when you can't participate in the discussion and the debate about matters that concern you, that makes you feel pretty damn un-American.
Well, yep,
aside
from the laws that are involved, has anybody considered suing Gannett or suing Scripps or suing the newspaper companies for denial of free speech? Right.
Well, again, they're private companies, so they don't have any obligation to provide a forum to anybody.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. The First Amendment is a prohibition on government intervention, but it's not a prohibition against the private sector.
Yeah.
I made one of my great friends in New Mexico mad when I made that point. You know, it's the government is prohibited from telling you that you cannot say something, or you must say something, or you can't go to church. But there's no prohibition. A church can tell you to get the hell out. the KOB radio can tell you, we don't want your kind calling in here. And you don't have the right under the Constitution to be free of private intervention. Now, we are moving in that direction in terms of some other things like public accommodations. My belief is that as we accept social media as an accommodation similar to other things, I think that the case law may develop that these entities can't do that because it results in the very isolation that you're talking about. So I believe case law will develop over time. It's all going to take time, though. Case law evolves very slowly. We typically run decades behind the times when it comes to particular with fast-moving technology.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. With that, I'm going to turn off the recording for starters.